Chapter 22. Italy joins the fray. Even before Salonika, grimacing war had dragged Italy into its dance of death. Did the Italian people want it? The historical evidence available today enables one to answer with a flat no. Even Mussolini, who was the Allies' outstanding supporter in Italy in 1915, had taken a stand against any participation in the conflict at its outset. Down with war. The time has come for the Italian proletariat to keep faith with the old watchword, not a man, not a cent. The extremist of 1914 would a little later become one of the most severely wounded soldiers of the Italian campaign, hit by dozens of shrapnel fragments. With the formation of the Triple Alliance, Germany-Austria-Turkey, it had been thought that Italy would be persuaded to enter the war on the side of the Alliance, to whom she was bound by treaty. But in 1914, as again in 1939, Italy, the land of Machiavelli, i.e., sensibly perspicacious, cared little for pretty sentiments, which often camouflaged cold calculation, and didn't pretend to be overly troubled by problems of conscience. What problems? The others had hardly been troubled by them in 1914. Wasn't it strictly its own self-interest that had prompted the Russian government to convert the Balkans into a shield? Was it not strictly in their own interest that the French politicians had made such use of the Russian cannon fodder to regain Alsace-Lorraine? Was the British establishment not motivated by interest and had used the pretext of the violation of Belgium in order to trip up a dangerous naval and business rival? Right is rouge that is put on for effect. Why should not self-interest, the law of nations, have been the barometer of the Italians as well? In international parlies, Italian politicians have no equals for maneuvering, protesting loudly, becoming indignant, throwing their arms in the air, and all but crying, as if the other negotiators were strangling them and murdering them. Comedy or tragedy, they play both roles to the hilt. When the Italian government declared its neutrality on August 3, 1914, it was motivated by just one idea, to cash in on that neutrality. Not to let anyone play on its sympathies, but to see which side would offer the most. Salandra, president of the Italian council, didn't mince words. He automatically put aside every preoccupation, every preconceived notion that was not exclusively inspired by the exclusive and unlimited devotion to the fatherland, by the sacred interest of Italy, October 16, 1914. But at the end of the autumn of 1914, what was the egoistically sacred and exclusive interest of that delightful country? To achieve its interest, was it absolutely necessary to take up arms in favor of one of the sides? I believe, sagely declared Giolitti, former president and a liberal in temperament, that under the present conditions in Europe, we might obtain something appreciable without war. That something appreciable was the Italian Trentino. The sons of Romulus and Remus had the teeth of a she-wolf, like their patroness of 2,500 years before. Many remembered ancient Rome, mistress of the world. Some of them, like Gabrielle D'Annunzio, dreamed theatrically of a grandiose immolation of the Italians. They will have to suffer resplendent bloodletting, to soothe a radiant grief. The Italian Trentino was a reasonable demand. For people of the same race and blood to be reunited was just as sound. Overdoing it and swallowing up foreign peoples against their will, on the other hand, was in keeping neither with the right, so highly praised, nor perhaps even with wisdom. Many are the nations in history that have suffered from an indigestion of alien peoples. What would be Italy's choice? And what was Vienna going to offer? At the outset, the Austrian government had dragged its feet. Then Franz Joseph warmed up to the idea of turning over the foothills of the southern Tyrol to Italy. Austria was even disposed to let her port of Trieste be turned into an independent state. As for Albania and the Turkish islands of the Dodecanese, Austria would give the Italians carte blanche. Without firing a single shot, Italy was thus able to make not merely appreciable but considerable gains. To obtain the Austrians' cooperation, Wilhelm II, who had no wish to see another enemy fall upon him, brought great pressure to bear on Vienna. He sent his former chancellor, Prince von Bülow, as a special plenipotentiary to Rome. Von Bülow was an Italophile and an Austrophobe, and the intimate friend, as was his wife, of the Italian Queen Mother. Until the last week of his stay, that is to say until May 21, 1915, he tactfully endeavored to keep Italy at peace, while striving to satisfy her territorial demands. On May 9, 1915, Prince von Bülow, accompanied by the ambassador of Austria-Hungary himself, confidentially presented the Italian government with the following note. Austria-Hungary is prepared to cede that part of the Tyrol inhabited by Italians, Gradisca, and the west bank of the Isonzo insofar as it is Italian. Trieste is to become a free city within the Austro-Hungarian Empire, with an Italian university and town council. Austria recognizes Italian sovereignty over Valona and states that she has no political interest in Albania. Fat presto, hurry it up, King Victor Emmanuel told von Bülow on several occasions when this very important offer was finally delivered to him. But without its being known in the embassies, the irretrievable had already taken place. 2 weeks earlier, on April 24, 1915, Italy had come to a secret understanding with the Allies in London. Victor Emmanuel had kept up appearances. When von Bülow had come to deliver to him personally a letter from William II ardently imploring him to remain faithful to their friendship and their treaty, the King of Italy had spoken of his duties vis-à-vis public opinion, the majority of the country, and the Parliament. In fact, no party in Rome had a majority in the spring of 1915. Only the common people, heavily subjected to Allied propaganda, had made clear their feelings. The Italian Minister of the Interior himself had clearly recognized it. If there were a plebiscite, the majority would vote against war. Giolitti, who was also against the war, had received the support of a large majority of the deputies, 320 out of 508. In a gesture absolutely unprecedented in a parliamentary government, those 320 deputies had come one by one to deliver their calling cards to the personal residence of the head of the neutralist party, in order to signify their refusal to side with the Allies. Salandra, the prime minister, felt himself so repudiated that he resigned. The labor unions, for their part, were massively opposed to entering the war. As for the people themselves, in reality they could hardly manifest their will democratically, because in 1915, 78% of the Italians still did not have the right to vote. At that time, an Italian had to possess a school diploma in order to vote. Thus, less than a fourth of the citizens were voters. How, then, was Italy's entry into the war brought about? With the help of street riots carried to the point of direct violence, fomented by bands of garibaldini, warmongers, who, by a wholesale breaking of windows, had forced their way into the Italian Parliament to cries of Viva la guerra. Allied funds, principally French, had been distributed in Rome with extreme generosity. The newspapers, showered with subsidies even more openly than the warmongering French press of 1914, had whipped up public feelings. Mussolini had founded a newspaper that was destined to become famous, Il Popolo d'Italia. The future fascist leader had made it an inflammatory sheet, exciting both a fury for war among his socialist readers and patriotism among the irredentists who dreamed of replanting the old fasces on a maximum of the lands of the old Roman Empire. D'Annunzio, with a bald skull atop an overexcited brain, and his lyre in hand, provided the epic tone. This warmongering movement also enjoyed the extremely active support of Freemasonry. All these interventionists combined constituted no more than a minority, but they raised a din like the geese of the Roman capital of old. No one else could be heard. They took to the streets, screamed, created havoc. Victor Emmanuel, frightened by the broken windowpanes of the Parliament building, refused Salandra's resignation. Salandra played only a modest role in this whole affair. He was a mediocre politician without any real power. The real wirepuller was a very bizarre Italian named Sonnino, a Jew born in Lebanon of a Jewish father and a Welsh mother. Another strange characteristic, his mother had made a Protestant of him, quite surprising in a country where almost everyone was a Catholic. Jew, Levantine, Protestant, half Welsh, Sonnino would be the standard bearer of internationalist Italy. The Austrian offer, however, offered the Italians considerable territorial advantages on a golden platter, and without a single one of their soldiers having to suffer a scratch. It was presented rather reluctantly, moreover, by the Austrians, who complained, not without reason, at the blackmail, but who, at the imperative urging of William II, had to resign themselves to yielding. Giolitti had asked Parecchio plenty. In the end, Italy was going to come away with all of the South Tyrol and an autonomous Trieste, as well as recognition of her freedom of action in Albania and the Dodecanese, without giving up a single lira or shedding a drop of blood. Italy is following a policy of blackmail against us that has no parallel in history, Bethmann Hollweg moaned, all the while he was giving into it. But they were at an auction sale. Sannino would sell Italy to the highest bidder. The Italian people, inflamed by the Allied propaganda, gave no thought to the possible cost of this foreign largesse. For the Allies were offering everything, the Italian Trentino most certainly, but the German Trentino as well, which would mean that hundreds of thousands of non-Italians would be absorbed by a foreign land without their consent. That, of course, was strictly contrary to the principle of self-determination for which the French and British politicians later claimed to be fighting. The people living along the shores of the Adriatic, similarly offered to Italy by the Allies, were to suffer the same violation of their right. Who asked the opinion of the inhabitants not only of Istria, but of Dalmatia? Of Albania? Of the entire string of coastal islands? They numbered in the millions, these largely Slavic and Albanian peoples whom the Allies were ready, out of self-interest, to turn into Italian citizens. It was for many of these South Slavs that the assassins of Sarajevo had unleashed the great European carnage on June 28, 1914. It was to assure a Slavic expansion as far as the Dalmatian ports in question that Russia's Panslavists had begun the military phase of the war. Now these territories were to be given to the Italians on the pretext that some emperor or other had had his villa there 2,000 years ago, and that some thousands of Italian fishermen and shopkeepers had gone ashore one day and taken residence there. But why, in that case, not promise Lyon, the native city of the Emperor Claudius, to Italy as well? Or Seville, the birthplace of the Emperor Trajan? Or even Paris, the ancient Roman Lutetia? And what of London, which Caesar had conquered? Russia, for her part, wanted no part of such an award of Balkan territory to Italy. Her leaders opposed it with all their might. But the front was collapsing, and Grand Duke Nicholas feared imminent disaster. So Russia had to accept it for the time being. In fact, however, she was determined to sabotage the Allied offer and nullify it at the first opportunity. And that was how it turned out. The Serbians, in 1919, would be the big winners in the Balkans. The Allies' promises, despite the treaties duly signed, were thus empty, a fundamentally immoral game that made a caricature out of the so edifying declarations made by the Defenders of Right in 1914. What is left to add about the territories in Asia Minor that the Allies offered to Sannino as extra booty? The Italians had demanded, in addition to the shores of the Adriatic and the German Brenner Pass, that they be granted Cilicia, southeast Anatolia, southern Cappadocia, and the region of Smyrna as an Asian gift. But the Greeks, when the Allies were begging for their intervention the following year, would surely demand in their turn similar annexations in Turkey. Likewise the Russians, who had entered the auction room first, on August 1, 1914. For their part, the British and French had already secretly chosen the morsels they would cut from the Turkish spoils for themselves. To the Arabs, finally, in order to entice them into the caravan of death, camels in the lead, the British in great secrecy had promised that the territories they inhabited would be converted into Arab states. Thus the same booty in the same area had been promised 3, 4, and 5 times. And by what right? All the inhabitants were Turkish subjects, i.e. were non-Europeans. Had they been consulted? Were they, the ones primarily concerned, willing to be auctioned off like chattels? Did they even have the slightest idea of these barter treaties concluded behind their backs? It was of no importance to the politicians. They were sold to the Italians, or more precisely to Sannino, who, through his father, had a bit of the Levant in him. In order to cement the deal, the Allies committed themselves to grant him even more territory, because, of course, they planned to snap up and divide the German colonies in Africa, Asia, and Oceania. To bring Italy into the war, they would have promised Vancouver and Valparaiso to Sannino if he had wanted them. These treacherous dealings would result in appalling disputes after the war. In 1918 and 1919, Clemenceau would heap insults upon Italy. But in 1915, Italy had to be seduced at any price, especially if the price could be paid by others. The Allies, if they wished to crush Germany, had an absolute need of another 1 or 2 million soldiers and a new battlefront, in order to take the pressure off the paralyzed Western Front, and to save Russia, whom the Austrians and Germans had by the throat, from utter disaster. Thus, on April 26, 1915, was signed the secret Italo-Allied Treaty, would be known to history as the Treaty of London. Italy pledged to declare war within a month. On May 21, 1915, it was done. In the course of the first weeks the Italians advanced to the Isonzo and then, in October 1915, to Lake Garda. They were able to enjoy a few local successes after that. But they were poorly armed and poorly commanded. At Caporetto they would suffer a crushing reverse. They would even be hurled back beyond the Piave. But they're fleeing, my lions. Marshal Cardona would cry. French units would have to rush to the rescue. In the end, instead of being aided by the Italians, the Allies would be forced to aid the Italians. In a word, they had violated the most elementary rights of peoples in the Treaty of London of April 26, 1915, only to embroil themselves in new complications, military complications that would quickly be followed by nationalistic animosities. The Italians would no longer be able to stand the French. The French, in turn, would hate the Italians. The intervention of Italy in the war in 1915 had no more effect than a sword thrust into water, or rather into a mire of blood. An evil business, from the start, it turned into a military disappointment. The Allies gained nothing, and it cost Italy the blood of her people. For a long time the Italians would detest the French and the British. Out of that great blighted hope, fascism would be born.